From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States Supreme Court is supposed to be the ultimate arbiter of the Constitution and of justice in the nation. And for decades, it often made rulings that pushed the nation closer to its stated ideals, one ruling at a time. Until President Richard Nixon came along and appointed four conservative justices in the span of just 3 years to the nine-person court. Since then, my guest Adam Cohen argues that the Supreme Court has been a leading force of inequality in the U.S. Now with President Donald Trump and his main accomplice, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, that rightward shift of the Supreme Court remains stronger than ever. Adam Cohen was a member of the New York Times editorial board and a senior writer for Time magazine. His earlier books are Imbeciles, The Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and The Sterilization of Carrie Buck, and Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America. He now joins me to discuss his latest book, Supreme Inequality, The Supreme Court's 50-Year Battle for a More Unjust America. Welcome to the program, Adam.
Great to be here.
So I mentioned the Supreme Court is often, you know, is essentially seen as this institution that is not meant to be partisan, that's not meant to lean one way or another. But pretty much most Americans these days who pay attention to the news realize that our Supreme Court is essentially a conservative institution. It's not really one that tends to lean liberal. And if it does, it's usually just marginally so. But that trend, you point out in your book, actually started with Richard Nixon. Tell me what it was that Richard Nixon put his stamp on the Supreme Court and why the court has since then not looked back.
Sure. It's hard to remember now, but there actually was a time when the court was a force for progressive ideas and progress for our society. And that was the Warren Court. Earl Warren, who had been the governor of California, comes in as Chief Justice in 1953. And within a year, the court hands down Brown versus Board of Education, the start of desegregating schools across the South. And then in the 50s and particularly 1960s, the Warren Court is doing things for poor people, for prisoners, for the mentally ill, on and on and on. And famous cases we've all heard of, like Gideon v. Wainwright, where they created a right to have a lawyer appointed if you're accused of a crime and you can't afford your own lawyer. The Miranda decision, which said you had the right to remain silent when police question you, things like that. So that was the Warren era, goes through 1968. Nixon is elected in that very close election of 1968, comes into office in 1969, and he really wants to end the Warren Court and replace it with a conservative court. He's got one big opportunity, which is that Warren had already said he was going to step down. So within just a few months, Nixon is able to replace this very progressive Chief Justice with a conservative, Warren Burger. And then just the way the things went, Nixon got four appointments in 3 years, enough to really change the court. One of those, and this is a story I tell in my book, was a vacancy Nixon created by really forcing, blackmailing one of the liberal justices, the most liberal justice, Abe Fortas, off of the court. And that created a key additional conservative seat. And it created this majority, the conservative majority, that's been with us to today. We've had 50 years since Nixon came in of a conservative court with a conservative chief justice.
And I want to focus on some of that history, but what you were just saying reminds me so much of what we saw done, not necessarily by Trump, but by Mitch McConnell in the last year of the Obama presidency, when the vacancy created by Antonin Scalia's death ought to have been filled by him. Mr. McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, just used such underhanded means to ensure that that Supreme Court vacancy was not filled by Barack Obama. And then, of course, we got Trump and Neil Gorsuch. And then eventually, after that, Brett Kavanaugh. And Trump is hoping for another 4 years so that he can replace justices like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So in these past 50 years, since the Nixon effect on the court, how conservative has the court become? Can you give us some examples? I mean, the Citizens United decision comes to mind, but that's quite recent.
Yes. So the first thing the court does is it stops this forward momentum of the Warren Court. And the Warren Court was actually really beginning to champion the rights of poor people and welfare recipients in particular. And it's hard to imagine now because we don't think of the court that way, but they were really striking down a lot of limitations on welfare recipients. There was something called the man in the house rule, where many states had a rule that if they could prove that a mother had a boyfriend who visited regularly, they would take away welfare benefits from the mother and the children also. The Supreme Court strikes that down in 1968. And other things, they struck down the poll tax. There's beginning to be a whole area of poverty law under the Supreme Court, new rights for the poor. The court stops that very quickly. But then in a number of areas, education is a very important one. Within a few years of the Nixon Court being created, the court gets two very important cases. One, Rodriguez v. San Antonio School Board in 1973, there was a challenge to Texas's school funding system, which, like almost every state, really every state except for one, directed much more money to wealthy districts than to poor districts. A district court judge, a federal district court court, ruled that that violated the Equal Protection Clause. And if that ruling had been upheld, it would have meant equalizing funding in rich and poor school districts all across the country. 5-4, the Supreme Court, with Nixon's appointees, strikes that down. A year later, 1974, a crucial case about segregation in Detroit called Milliken v. Bradley. There, the federal district court judge ruled that we had to have busing between inner city Detroit, which was overwhelmingly Black, and the very white suburbs so that the Black kids in Detroit could have an integrated education. Supreme Court 5-4 says, can't bus kids over the urban suburban line. So education, one area where they really built inequality into our system. Then, as you mentioned, Citizens United, yes, is recent, but starting in 1976, the court really focused in on campaign finance. And there was a critical decision there called Buckley versus Vallejo. First time the court says that money is speech. And it uses that First Amendment argument, which I believe is completely wrong, to begin striking down congressional campaign finance regulations. And they do that all the way till, as you say, Citizens United, when they take the really outrageous position that corporations have a right to spend their own money. Other areas as well, employment law, criminal law, as I explained in the book, this Supreme Court, the Nixon Court through today, is a major reason for our over-incarceration crisis. So I think much of the inequality we see in America today is really a result of the 50 years of what this court has done.
It seems as though race and class, broadly speaking, are those areas where we've seen setbacks in this court. And of course, that's not a surprise given that racial inequality and the class divide are very American phenomena that have required justices and required the judiciary to sort of step in and rule on, to protect the Constitution. So would you say, broadly speaking, that the past, the Nixon court and the future iterations of that have essentially taken rulings to favor wealthy white elites in America?
Absolutely. And the way I talk about it a lot in the book is that they favor the rich and powerful over the poor and weak. And it's absolutely correlates very strongly with race, but also they tend to favor employers, bosses over workers. They like management. They don't like labor unions. They like rich campaign contributors. They don't like voters. And there are many examples of this. And one area that's very relevant to what we're going through right now is the area of election law, where we see that they've given so much power to the people who run elections, really to stop people from voting. So things like they've upheld very strict voter ID laws, and that makes it hard for poor and minority voters to vote because many poor and minority voters don't have government-issued photo ID. The court doesn't care about that. But at the same time, they've been very activist about doing things like striking out the heart of the Voting Rights Act, which was really the jewel of the civil rights movement. The Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965 after people died fighting for the right to vote. It was supported by bipartisan majorities in Congress over and over again. It got reauthorized, signed into law by Republican and Democratic presidents. And this Supreme Court comes along and strikes out the heart of it, as Representative John Lewis said. And that was the pre-clearance requirement, the requirement that before election officials can change the rules in a way that may stop minorities from voting, they need to get approval from a federal court or the Justice Department. The Supreme Court, on totally bogus grounds, strikes that down. So I think what you're saying is exactly right. It's a really reflexive favoring of wealthy whites and those in power over everyone else.
Is this the result of deliberate organizing by conservatives to ensure a conservative-leaning America that favors wealthy white elites? Or are these, you know, accidents of history?
It was very much planned. And, you know, I'm not going to say it was only planned, you know, just to help, you know, whites and wealthy elites, although that was very much part of it. But, you know, this is the conservative movement that, you know, favors business, favors the wealthy, favors those who are, you know, doing well in our society. And, you know, that's why, you know, I started in 1968, because we see Nixon had a plan. He wasn't just looking for, let's get the most qualified people on the court, people who had good grades in law school or wrote very important scholarship in various areas. He wanted a right-wing court that agreed with his view that the Warren Court was going in the wrong direction. So that was the plan of the Nixon takeover, and that was the way the Republicans have acted when they've had vacancies to fill. And we've seen that with the Trump appointments, right? I mean, Trump didn't just go out and say, I'd like to find a qualified justice. He worked with the Federalist Society. He worked with evangelical groups and right-wing groups to make sure that Kavanaugh and Gorsuch were people that they knew would do the things they wanted. So it was very much a plan to have the kind of court these folks want. And you know what? They succeeded.
Now, the Supreme Court justices are supposed to follow the Constitution, right? They're supposed to follow precedents. They're supposed to apply the law, or interpret the law rather, and have a strict interpretation of the law. They're not supposed to be partisan. They're not supposed to be activists. They're not supposed to have their own political agenda inform their decisions. But we know, just observing the Supreme Court today, that the justices do that. But is it mostly the conservative justices that tend to be the activist ones, or the liberal ones, have become activists as well to try to balance what they see on the right side of the court?
Well, you know, it's funny, when people attacked the Warren Court back in the 60s, and they did all the time, they accused it of being an activist court. And they said, you know, the court is creating all these new rights for poor people and for criminal defendants and writing things into the Constitution that aren't there. And they attacked the court for being activist. And that became really the touchstone of conservatives, was the idea that liberals were activists. And, you know, you may remember that when John Roberts was nominated to be Chief Justice, he famously said at his confirmation hearings that he thought a judge should be an umpire, calling balls and strikes and nothing more. And that's the rhetoric of the conservatives. You know, we don't believe in activism. But lo and behold, when you look at what they have done when they got a majority, is to be incredibly activist, to do things like the Voting Rights Act decision that I mentioned. You know, the doctrine that they used, one of equal sovereignty between the states, is really a made-up doctrine. Even Judge Richard Posner, a conservative judge appointed by Ronald Reagan to one of the courts of appeals, even Richard Posner said when that decision came down that this doctrine of equal sovereignty of the states doesn't exist. The conservatives just made it up. So what we've seen is that when the conservatives got 5 votes for the substantive decisions they wanted, they become incredibly activist when they want to be. When it's a law that they want to uphold, like a strict voter ID law, or, you know, partisan gerrymandering, where Republicans draw all the lines in the legislative map so that Republicans will win most of the races, then suddenly they're not activists. But it's very much about what result they want.
So it's basically a court that has been designed by conservatives for conservatives.
Yes.
So when we look at then what has happened in the last decade or so, what did the John Roberts Court represent a blip? Have we seen chief justices, you know, since the Nixon era, more centrist than not?
Well, you know, it turns out actually that the blip was the liberal Warren Court, you know, because we have this idea that the Supreme Court is a force for justice, right? And, you know, they're all, the 9 of them are called justices, right? And we have this idea that the Supreme Court, you know, is about desegregating segregated schools and things like that. But that's very much the outlier. If you look at the history of the Supreme Court, you know, during the Civil War, the Supreme Court was on the side of the slaveholders. You know, the famous decision we all read in high school and college, Dred Scott, the Supreme Court said a black man who was a slave had no right to sue for his freedom. After the Civil War, when there was tremendous segregation in the South, Plessy versus Ferguson was a case that challenged segregated railroad cars, where blacks had to sit in separate cars from whites. Supreme Court upheld that. The previous book I wrote before this was about the 1920s, when the Supreme Court upheld eugenic sterilization in a really infamous case called Buck versus Bell. Actually, more than half the states had passed laws allowing the states to sterilize young women and men who they thought had bad genes, and really it was mainly poor people and other people that, you know, were not socially approved of. 70,000 people were sterilized under these laws. It goes up to the Supreme Court. They uphold that. And also in the 20s, the progressive era, the court regularly is striking down progressive laws, like laws against child labor and things like that. In the 30s, at the beginning of the New Deal, the court strikes down FDR's first big New Deal programs until he threatens to pack the court. So what you really have is a really right-wing conservative court throughout history that's always favored the slaveholders and the bosses and the manufacturers and all that. We had this brief period in the 60s, a little bit of the 50s, when the Warren Court did otherwise. But I say that the last 50 years, the court has reverted to its true role in our history, which is siding with the powerful against, you know, the regular people.
So if the Warren Court was a blip, how it sounds as though our court system, our Supreme Court system, at least, by design is an unjust one. How would you take a systemic view of this Supreme Court?
Well, there are a number of different approaches to how do we solve this problem. I mean, I think the simplest, most direct way is it's really important for Democrats to win this coming presidential election. And it makes a big difference if we get appointees like Sonia Sotomayor rather than appointees like Neil Gorsuch. So I think that if a Democrat wins, that could be the start of getting at least a more, you know, at least centrist court, because none of the, you know, quote, liberals on the court are really that liberal, but they're much better than the conservatives. There have also been proposals that go a little bit further that talk about things like maybe we need to expand the court and do something that FDR was talking about in the 1930s when the court kept striking down his New Deal legislation. He talked about packing the court, creating additional seats on the court. That actually would not be so hard.
So more than 9 seats on the court?
Exactly. We could make it 12 or 15. And the thing is, that's not set in the Constitution. There didn't used to be 9 justices on the court when the Supreme Court was first created. Congress could pass a law that the president signs that could expand the number of people on the court. We could imagine, you know, if a Democrat is elected president this year, and if the Democrats were able to take the Senate as well, they could do that. So that's a possibility. And even if you don't actually do it, the fact that folks are talking about it now may have a bit of an effect on the conservatives on the court, just like FDR threatening to do it had an effect.
Right. I mean, we're talking about...
There's
the issue of, you know, just small number statistics. I mean, when you have just 9 justices and a 5-4 decision, you know, is essentially what a lot of these decisions end up as. So just one person out of 9 that can tilt decisions one way or another and can completely change the way in which, you know, country is run in terms of policies that we have to follow. But if you have bigger numbers, then you have a little bit more of a spread, a more, you know, bigger number statistics to fall back on.
I think that's right. And also just look at the real oddity that, as we've mentioned, the court has been right-wing for 50 years, right? Mm-hmm. Think about the other two branches of government in that time. We've had conservative presidents and we've had liberal presidents, Democrats and Republicans. We've had Republicans in charge of the House and the Senate and Democrats. Generally, the branches swing back and forth and that creates something of a moderating effect. Only this one branch of government has been controlled by one extreme of one party for 50 years. And that's really, there's something unnatural about that.
Have Democrats just not appointed liberal enough judges, or have they just gotten unlucky with not being able to get the right numbers of appointments during their tenures?
you know, it's a combination of factors. One is the Republicans have had the White House a little bit longer in that time, so they've had a little bit more years to make appointments. The Republicans are much more strategic about timing their resignation. So we saw Anthony Kennedy resign to make way for Kavanaugh, even though Anthony Kennedy was in perfectly good health and didn't need to resign, but he knew it was the last moment he could step down and be sure that there would be a Republican President Trump and a Republican majority in the Senate who would pick his successor. Republicans have done that regularly. Democrats don't do that. You know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg didn't step down during the Obama administration when Obama could have replaced her with a liberal. But the other thing is, as we've discussed, a key part of it is the Republicans just play hardball more. So in 1969, Nixon steals the Fortas seat by threatening to put Fortas and his wife in prison, even though they didn't commit any crimes, drives him off the court, takes that seat. And then, as you mentioned, you know, flash forward to just a couple of years ago, and Mitch McConnell holds on to Scalia's seat, doesn't let Obama fill it, blocks Merrick Garland. And those two thefts of seats absolutely, you know, created the conservative majority and retained it.
Finally, Adam, do you feel that not enough Americans pay attention to this issue of who makes up the Supreme Court? I mean, of course, we saw the big protests around the Kavanaugh appointment that was perhaps more linked to the Me Too movement, but also, you know, people's fear about losing the right to abortion. But in general, do you feel that this is an issue that maybe comes up once every 4 years or when there's a vacancy on the Supreme Court, and the rest of the time we don't think about it, or we're just sort of resigned to the fact that we seem to not be able to control it?
I think progressives don't think about it as much as the Republicans who are obsessed with it. I think you're absolutely right. Also, we tend to think of it in terms of the Supreme Court or, you know, a Me Too issue, and not to focus on the fact that, as I argue in my book, the Supreme Court has been a major driver of income inequality. When we look around and ask why are rich people and corporations so rich now and the middle class hollowing out and poor people, you know, struggling so hard, a big part of it is 50 years of Supreme Court rulings. And if we want to end inequality in this country, economic inequality, the Supreme Court has to be part of that. So I would like, you know, candidates for office, and particularly the presidential candidates, to start talking about it more. And we, you know, on the progressive side of things, really need to make the Supreme Court and changing it a high priority.
So finally, in terms of what you foresee happening in the next, you know, year, maybe 4 years, if Trump wins re-election, all bets are off, right? I mean, I don't think Ruth Bader Ginsburg can hang on another 4.5 years on the court. If Trump wins re-election, he's going to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and then going from a 5-4 conservative majority, we go to a 6-3 conservative majority, and that's the end of any progressive decision-making on the court for a long time, because he's probably going to elect appoint not just a conservative, but a young conservative, as Gorsuch and Kavanaugh have been.
That's exactly right. And also, the decisions may get a lot worse. I mean, you know, I argue in the book that they've done a lot to create inequality now, but if they get another seat on the court, we may see them start to do really bold right-wing things, like start to strike down important federal laws like the food stamp law, SNAP, or, you know, some of the welfare laws, things like that. The essence of the social safety net, such as we have them, they may start to say that those are unconstitutional under the Commerce Clause. So we could see a radicalized right-wing Supreme Court if Trump is reelected. So absolutely, this election is so, so important for the future, not just of the Supreme Court, but for all of the things we care about in society.
Adam Ona, thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with your book. Really appreciate your time.
I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Adam Cohen about his latest book, Supreme Inequality: The Supreme Court's 50-Year Battle for a More Unjust America. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.